off the ugly clouds, but no blind eye of a mortal was permitted to spy them. So then came minstrels, having gold trumpets, harps, and drums. These played very loudly beside me, breaking that spell. So the dream vanished, whereat I thanked heaven. I shed many tears before the thin moon rose up, frail and faint as a sickle of straw. Now, though the enchanter gnash his teeth vainly, yet shall he return as the spring returns. Oh, wretched man I, hell gapes, Erebus now lies open. The mouths of death wait on my end.
Opt in, go to.
Hear now the words. Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
This is show number 18, the thrilling conclusion of The Moon Pool, and also of Citadel of Lost Ships by Leigh Brackett. It just happened to work out that way. I apologize, I'm not in the best voice today. We've been having some kind of equinoctial gale here, and between the pollen and just plain dirt, I could pass for the consumptive heroine in a Victorian novel.
Chapter 34. The Coming of the Shining One. The Norseman turned toward us. There was now no madness in his eyes, only a great weariness, and there was peace on the once tortured face. Helma, he whispered, I go a little before. Soon you will come to me and the Endling who will await you. Helma, in a lieb. Blood gushed from his mouth. He swayed, fell, and thus died Olaf Huldrickson. We looked down upon him, nor did Lachla, nor Larry, nor I try to hide our tears, and as we stood the Akka brought to us that other mighty fighter, Rador, but in him there was life, and we attended to him there as best we could. Then Lachla spoke. We will bear him into the castle, where we may give him greater care, she said, for lo, the hosts of Yolar have been beaten back, and on the bridge comes Nak with tidings. We looked over the parapet. It was even as she said. Neither on ledge nor bridge was there trace of living men of Muria, only heaps of slain that lay everywhere, and thick against the cavern mouth there still danced the flashing atoms of those the green ray had destroyed. "Over!" exclaimed Larry incredulously. "We live, then, heart of mine!" "The Silent Ones recall their veils," she said, pointing to the dome. Back through the slitted opening the radiance was streaming, withdrawing from sea and island, marching back over the bridge with that same ordered, intelligent motion. Behind it the red light pressed like skirmishers on the heels of a retreating army. "And yet," faltered the handmaiden as we passed into her chamber, and doubtful were the eyes she turned upon the O'Keefe. "I don't believe," he says, "there's a kick left in them." What was that sound beating into the chamber faintly, so faintly? My heart gave a great throb and seemed to stop for an eternity. What was it? Coming nearer, ever nearer. Now Lachlan O'Keefe heard it, life ebbing from lips and cheeks. Nearer, nearer, a music as of myriads of tiny crystal bells, tinkling, tinkling, a storm of pizzicati upon violins of glass. Nearer, nearer, not sweetly now, nor luring, no, raging, wrathful, sinister beyond words, sweeping on, nearer, the dweller! The Shining One! We leapt to the narrow window, peered out aghast. The bell notes swept through and about us, a hurricane. The crescent strand was once more a ferment. Back, back were the Akka being swept as though by brooms, tottering on the edge of the ledge, falling into the water. Swiftly they were finished, and where they had fought was an eddying throng, clothed in tatters or naked, swaying, drifting, arms tossing like marionettes of Satan. The dead alive, the slaves of the Dweller! They swayed and tossed, and then, like water racing through an open dam, they swept upon the bridgehead. On and on they pushed, like the bore of a mighty tide. The frogmen strove against them, clubbing, spearing, tearing them, but even those worst smitten seemed not to fall. On they pushed, driving forward, irresistible, a battering ram of flesh and bone. They clove the masses of the Akka, pressing them to the sides of the bridge, and over. Through the open gates they forced them, for there was no room for the frogmen to stand against that implacable tide. Then those of the Akka who were left turned their backs and ran. We heard the clang of the golden wings of the portal, and none too soon to keep out the first of the dwellers' dreadful hordes. Now upon the cavern ledge, and over the whole length of the bridge, there were none but the dead alive. Men and women, black-poled Ladala, slow-eyed Malays, slant-eyed Chinese, men of every race that sailed the seas, milling, turning, swaying like leaves caught in a sluggish current. The bell notes became sharper, more insistent. At the cavern mouth, iridescence began to grow, a gleaming from which the atoms of diamond dust seemed to try to flee. As the radiance grew, and the crystal notes rang nearer, every head of that hideous multitude turned stiffly, slowly toward the right, looking toward the far bridge end, their eyes fixed and glaring, every face an inhuman mask of rapture and of horror. A movement shook them. Those in the center began to stream back, faster and ever faster, leaving motionless deep ranks on each side. Back they flowed until, from golden doors to cavern mouth, a wide lane stretched, walled on each side by the dead alive. The far radiance became brighter. It gathered itself at the end of the dreadful lane. It was shot with sparklings and with pulsings of polychromatic light. The crystal storm was intolerable, piercing the ears with countless tiny lances, brighter still with the radiance. From the cavern swirled the Shining One! The dweller paused, seemed to scan the island of the Silent Ones half doubtfully, then slowly, stately, it drifted out upon the bridge. Closer it drew, behind it glided Yolara at the head of a company of her dwarfs. And at her side was the hag of the council, whose face was the withered, shattered echo of her own. Slower grew the dweller's pace as it drew nearer. Did I sense in it a doubt, an uncertainty? The crystal-tongued, unseen choristers that accompanied it subtly seemed to reflect the doubt. Their notes were not sure, no longer insistent. Rather, there was in them an undertone of hesitancy, of warning. Yet on came the Shining One, until it stood plain beneath us, searching with those eyes that thrust from and withdrew into unknown spheres, the golden gateway, the cliff face, the castle's rounded bulk, and more intently than any of these, the dome wherein sat the three. Behind it, each face of the dead alive turned toward it, and those beside it throbbed and gleamed with its luminescence. Yolara crept close, just beyond the reach of its spirals. She murmured, and the dweller bent toward her. Its seven globes steady in their shining mists as though listening. It drew erect once more, resumed its doubtful scrutiny. Yolara's face darkened. She had turned abruptly, spoke to a captain of her guards. A dwarf raced back between the palisades of dead alive. Now the priestess cries out, her voice ringing like a silver clarion. "Ye are done, ye three! The Shining One stands at your door, demanding entrance. Your beasts are slain and your power is gone. Who are ye," says the Shining One, "to deny it entrance to the place of its birth?" "Ye do not answer," she cried again. "Yet know that we hear. The Shining One offers these terms. Send forth your handmaiden, and that lying stranger she stole. Send them forth to us, and perhaps ye may live. But if ye send them not forth, then ye too shall die, and soon." We waited, silent, even as did Yolara, and again there was no answer from the three. The priestess laughed, the blue eyes flashed. "It is ended," she cried. "If you will not open, needs must we open for you." Over the bridge was marking a long double file of the dwarfs. They bore a smooth and handled tree trunk whose head was knobbed with a huge ball of metal. Past the priestess, past the Shining One, they carried it. 50 of them to each side of the ram, and behind them stepped Marakanoff. Larry awoke to life. "Now, thank God," he rasped, "I can get that devil anyway." He drew his pistol, took careful aim. Even as he pressed the trigger, there rang through the abode a tremendous clanging. The ram was battering at the gates. O'Keefe's bullet went wild. The Russian must have heard the shot. Perhaps the missile was closer than we knew. He made a swift leap behind the guards, was lost to sight. Once more the thunderous clanging rang through the castle. Lachla drew herself erect. Down upon her dropped the listening aloofness. Gravely she bowed her head. "It is time, O love of mine," she turned to O'Keefe. "The Silent Ones say that the way of fear is closed, but the way of love is open. They call upon us to redeem our promise." For 100 heartbeats they clung to each other, breast to breast and lip to lip. Below the clangor was increasing, the great trunk swinging harder and faster upon the metal gates. Now Lachla gently loosed the arms of the O'Keefe, and for another instant those two looked into each other's souls. The handmaiden smiled tremulously. "I would it might have been otherwise, Larry darlin," she whispered, "but at least we pass together, dearest of mine." She leapt to the window. "Yolara!" The golden voice rang out sweetly. The clanging ceased. "Draw back your men. We open the portal and come forth to you and the Shining One, Larry and I." The priestess' silver chimes of laughter rang out, cruel, mocking. "Come, then, and quickly," she jeered, "for surely both the Shining One and I yearn for you." Her malice-laden laughter chimed high once more. "Keep us not lonely long," the priestess mocked. Larry drew a deep breath, stretched both hands out to me. "It's goodbye, I guess, Doc." His voice was strained. "Goodbye and good luck, old boy. If you get out, and you will, let the old dolphin know I'm gone. And carry on, pal, and always remember the O'Keefe loved you like a brother." I squeezed his hands desperately. Then, out of my balance-shaking woe, a strange comfort was born. "Maybe it's not goodbye, Larry," I cried. "The Banshee has not cried." A flash of hope passed over his face. The old reckless grin shone forth. "It's so," he said. "By the Lord, it's so." Then Lochla bent toward me, and for the second time kissed me. "Come," she said to Larry. Hand in hand they moved away, into the corridor that led to the door outside of which waited the Shining One and its priestess. And unseen by them, wrapped as they were within their love and sacrifice, I crept softly behind, for I had determined that if enter the dweller's embrace they must, they should not go alone. They paused before the golden portals. The handmaiden pressed its opening lever. The massive leaves rolled back. Heads high, proudly, serenely, they passed through and out upon the hither span. I followed. On each side of us stood the dweller's slaves, faces turned rigidly toward their master. 100 feet away, the Shining One pulsed and spiraled in its evilly glorious lambency of sparkling plumes. Unhesitating, always with that same high serenity, Lochla and the O'Keefe, hands clasped like little children, drew closer to that wondrous shape. I could not see their faces, but I saw awe fall upon those of the watching dwarfs, and into the burning eyes of Yolara crept a doubt. Closer they drew to the dweller, and closer I following them step by step. The Shining One's whirling lessened. Its tinklings were faint, almost stilled. It seemed to watch them apprehensively. A silence fell upon us all, a thick silence, brooding, ominous, palpable. Now the pair were face to face with the child of the three, so near that with one of its misty tentacles it could have enfolded them. And the Shining One drew back. Yes, drew back, and back with it stepped Yolara, the doubt in her eyes deepening. Onward paced the handmaiden and the O'Keefe, and step by step as they advanced the dweller withdrew, its bell notes chiming out, puzzled, questioning, half fearful. And back it drew, and back, until it had reached the very center of that platform over the abyss in whose depths pulsed the green fires of Earthheart. And there Yolara gripped herself. The hell that seethed within her soul leapt out of her eyes. A cry, a shriek of rage tore from her lips. As at a signal, the Shining One flamed high. Its spirals and eddying mists swirled madly. The pulsing core of it blazed radiance. A score of coruscating tentacles swept straight upon the pair who stood intrepid, unresisting, awaiting its embrace. And upon me, lurking behind them. Through me swept a mighty exaltation. It was the end, then, and I was to meet it with them. Something drew us back. Back with an incredible swiftness, and yet as gently as a summer breeze sweeps a bit of thistledown. Drew us back from those darting misty arms, even as they were a hairbreadth from us. I heard the dweller's bell notes burst out ragingly. I heard Yolara scream. What was that? Between the three of us and them was a ring of curdled moon flames, swirling about the Shining One and its priestess, pressing in upon them, enfolding them. And within it I glimpsed the faces of the three, implacable, sorrowful, filled with a supernal power. Sparks and flashes of white flame darted from the ring, penetrating the radiant swathings of the dweller, striking through its pulsing nucleus, piercing its 7 crowning orbs. Now the Shining One's radiance began to dim, the 7 orbs to dull, the tiny sparkling filaments that ran from them down into the dweller's body snapped, vanished. Through the battling nebulosities, Yolara's face swam forth, horror-filled, distorted, inhuman. The ranks of the dead alive quivered, moved, writhed, as though each felt the torment of the thing that had enslaved them. The radiance that the three wielded grew more intense, thicker, seemed to expand. Within it, suddenly, were scores of flaming triangles, scores of eyes like those of the Silent Ones. And the Shining Ones, 7 little moons, of amber, of silver, of blue and amethyst and green, of rose and white, split, shattered, were gone. Abruptly, the tortured crystal chiming ceased. Dulled, all its soul-shaking beauty dead, blotched and shadowed squalidly, its gleaming plumes tarnished, its dancing spirals stripped from it, that which had been the Shining One wrapped itself about Yolara, wrapped and drew her into itself, writhed, swayed, and hurled itself over the edge of the bridge, down, down into the green fires of the unfathomable abyss, with its priestess still enfolded in its coils. From the dwarfs who had watched that terror came screams of panic fear. They turned and ran, racing frantically over the bridge toward the cavern mouth. The serried ranks of the dead alive trembled, shook. Then from their faces fled the horror of wedded ecstasy and anguish. Peace, utter peace, followed in its wake. And as fields of wheat are bent and fall beneath the wind, they fell. No longer dead alive, now all of the blessed dead, freed from their dreadful slavery. Abruptly, from the sparkling mists, the cloud of eyes was gone. Faintly revealed in them were only the heads of the silent ones. And they drew before us, were before us, no flames now in their ebon eyes, for the flickering fires were quenched in great tears, streaming down the marble-white faces. They bent toward us, over us, their radiance enfolded us. My eyes darkened. I could not see. I felt a tender hand upon my head, and panic and frozen dread and nightmare web that held me fled. Then they too were gone. Upon Larry's breast the handmaiden was sobbing, sobbing out her heart, but this time with the joy of one who has swept up from the very threshold of hell into paradise. Chapter 35. Larry, farewell. My heart, Larry, it was the handmaiden's murmur. My heart feels like a bird that is flying from a nest of sorrow. We were pacing down the length of the bridge, guards of the Akka beside us, others following with those companies of the Ladala that had rushed to aid us. In front of us, the bandaged Rador swung gently within a litter. Beside him in another lay Nak, the Frog King, much less of him than there had been before the battle began, but living. Hours had passed since the terror I have just related. My first task had been to search for Throckmorton and his wife, among the falling multitudes strewn thick as autumn leaves along the flying arch of stone, over the cavern ledge, and back as far as the eye could reach. At last, Lachla and Larry helping, we found them. They lay close to the bridge end, not parted, locked tight in each other's arms, pallid face to face, her hair streaming over his breast. As though when that unearthly life the dweller had set within them passed away, their own had come back for one fleeting instant, and they had known each other, and clasped before kindly death had taken them. Love is stronger than all things. The handmaiden was weeping softly. Love never left them. Love was stronger than the Shining One, and when its evil fled, love went with them wherever souls go. Of Stanton and Thora there was no trace, nor after our discovery of those two did I care to look more. They were dead, and they were free. We buried Throckmorton and Edith beside Olaf in Lachla's bower, but before the body of my old friend was placed within the grave, I gave it a careful and sorrowful examination. The skin was firm and smooth, but cold, not the cold of death, but with a chill that set my touching fingers tingling unpleasantly. The body was bloodless, the course of veins and arteries marked by faintly indented white furrows, as though their walls had long collapsed. Lips, mouth, even the tongue was paper white. There was no sign of dissolution as we know it, no shadow or stain upon the marble surface. Whatever the force that, streaming from the dweller or impregnating its lair, had energized the dead alive, it was barrier against putrescence of any kind, that at least was certain. But it was not barrier against the poison of the Medusae, for, our sad task done, and looking down upon the waters, I saw the pale forms of the dweller's hordes dissolving, vanishing into the shifting glories of the gigantic moons sailing down upon them from every quarter of the Sea of Crimson. While the frogmen, those late levies from the farthest forests, were clearing bridge and ledge of cavern of the litter of the dead, we listened to a leader of the Ladala. They had risen, even as the messenger had promised Rador. Fierce had been the struggle in the Garden City by the Silver Waters, with those Lugur and Yolara had left behind to garrison it. Deadly had been the slaughter of the fair-haired, reaping the harvest of hatred they had been sowing so long. Not without a pang of regret did I think of the beautiful, gaily malicious elfin women destroyed, evil though they may have been. The ancient city of Lara was a charnel. Of all the rulers, not 20 had escaped, and these into regions of peril which to describe as sanctuary would be mockery. Nor had the Ladala fared so well. Of all the men and women, for women as well as men had taken their part in the swift war, not more than 1/10 remained alive. And the dancing motes of light in the silver air were thick, thick, they whispered. They told us of the Shining One rushing through the veil, comet-like, its hosts streaming behind it, raging with it, in ranks that seemed interminable. of the massacre of the priests and priestesses in the Cyclopean temple, of the flashing forth of the summoning lights by unseen hands, followed by the tearing of the rainbow curtain, by colossal shatterings of the radiant cliffs, the vanishing behind their debris of all trace of entrance to the haunted place wherein the hordes of the Shining One had slaved, the sealing of the lair. Then, when the tempest of hate had ended in seething Lara, how, thrilled with victory, armed with the weapons of those they had slain, they had lifted the shadow, passed through the portal, met and slaughtered the fleeing remnants of Yolara's men, only to find the tempest stilled here, too. But of Marakanoff they had seen nothing. Had the Russian escaped, I wondered, or was he lying out there among the dead? But now the Ladala were calling upon Lakla to come with them, to govern them. "I don't want to, Larry Darlin," she told him. "I want to go out with you, to Ireland, but for a time I think the three would have us remain, and set that place in order." The O'Keefe was bothered about something else than the government of Muria. "If they have killed off all the priests, who's to marry us, heart of mine?" he worried. "None of those Sia and Siana rites, no matter what," he added hastily. "Marry?" cried the handmaiden incredulously. "Marry us? Why, Larry, dear, we are married." The O'Keefe's astonishment was complete. His jaw dropped. Collapse seemed imminent. "We are?" he gasped. "When?" he stammered fatuously. "Why, when the mother drew us together before her, when she put her hands on our heads after we had made the promise. Didn't you understand that?" asked the handmaiden wonderingly. He looked at her, into the purity of the clear golden eyes, into the purity of the soul that gazed out of them, all his own great love transfiguring his keen face. "And is that enough for you, Mavourneen?" he whispered humbly. "Enough?" The handmaiden's puzzlement was complete, profound. "Enough? Larry, darling, what more could we ask?" He drew a deep breath, clasped her close. "Kiss the bride, Doc," cried the O'Keefe, "and for the third and soul's sorrow, the last time, Lakla, dimpling and blushing, I thrilled to the touch of her soft, sweet lips." Quickly were our preparations for departure made. Rador, conscious, his immense vitality conquering fast his wounds, was to be borne ahead of us, and when all was done, Lakla, Larry, and I made our way up the scarlet stone that was the doorway to the chamber of the three. We knew, of course, that they had gone, following, no doubt, those whose eyes I had seen in the curdled mists, and who, coming to the aid of the three at last from whatever mysterious place it was their home, had shown their strength with them against the Shining One. Nor were we wrong. When the great slab rolled away, no torrents of opalescence came rushing out upon us. The vast dome was dim, tenantless. Its curved walls that had cascaded light shone now but faintly. The dais was empty, its walls of moon-flame radiance gone. A little time we stood, heads bent, reverent, our hearts filled with gratitude and love, yes, and with pity for that strange trinity so alien to us and yet so near, children even as we, though so unlike us, of the same Mother Earth. And what, I wondered, had been the secret of that promise they had wrung from their handmaiden and from Larry, and whence, if what the three had said had been all true, whence had come their power to avert the sacrifice at the very verge of its consummation? "Love is stronger than all things," had said Lakla. Was it that, indeed, they needed? Must have the force which dwells within love, within willing sacrifice, to strengthen their own power and to enable them to destroy the evil, glorious things so long shielded by their own love? Did the thought of sacrifice, the will toward abnegation, have to be as strong as the Eternals, unshaken by faintest thrill of hope, before the three could make of it their key to unlock the Dweller's guard and strike through it its life? Here was a mystery. A mystery indeed. Lakla softly closed the crimson stone. The mystery of the red dwarf's appearance was explained when we discovered a half dozen of the water coria moored in a small cove not far from where the secta flashed their heads of living bloom. The dwarfs had borne the shallops with them, and from somewhere beyond the cavern ledge had launched them unperceived, stealing up the further side of the island and risking all in one bold stroke. Well, Lugur, no matter what he held of wickedness, held also high courage. The cavern was paved with the dead alive, the Akka carrying them out by the hundreds, casting them into the waters. Through the lane down which the dweller had passed, we went as quickly as we could, coming at last to the place where the Coria waited. And not long after, we swung past where the shadow had hung and hovered over the shining depths of the midnight pool. Upon Lakla's insistence, we passed on to the palace of Lugur, not to Yolara's. I do not know why, but to go there then she would not. And within one of its columned rooms, the maidens of the black-haired folks, the wistfulness, the fear all gone from their sparkling eyes, served us. There came to me a huge desire to see the destruction they had told us of the dweller's lair, to observe for myself whether it was not possible to make a way of entrance, and to study its mysteries. I spoke of this, and to my surprise, both the handmaiden and the O'Keefe showed an almost embarrassed haste to acquiesce in my hesitant suggestion. "Sure," said Larry. "There's lots of time before night." He caught himself sheepishly, cast a glance at Lachlan. "I keep forgetting there's no night here," he mumbled. "What did you say, Larry?" asked she. "I said I wish we were sitting in our home in Ireland, watching the sun go down," he whispered to her. Vaguely I wondered why she blushed. "But now I must hasten. We went to the temple, and here at least the ghastly litter of the dead had been cleaned away. We passed through the blue cavern space, crossed the narrow arch that spanned the rushing sea stream, and ascending, stood again upon the ivoried pave at the foot of the frowning, towering amphitheater of jet. Across the silver waters there was sign of neither web of rainbows, nor colossal pillars, nor the templed lips that I had seen curving out beneath the veil when the Shining One had swirled out to greet its priestess and its voice, and to dance with the sacrifices. There was but a broken and rent mass of the radiant cliffs, against whose base the lake lapped. Long I looked, and turned away saddened, knowing even as I did what the irised curtain had hidden, still it was as though some thing of supernal beauty and wonder had been swept away, never to be replaced, a glamour gone forever, a work of the high gods destroyed. "Let's go back," said Larry abruptly. I dropped a little behind them to examine a bit of carving, and after all they did not want me. I watched them pacing slowly ahead, his arm around her, black hair close to bronze-gold ringlets. Then I followed. Half were they over the bridge, when through the roar of the imprisoned stream I heard my name called softly. "Goodwin! Dr. Goodwin!" Amazed, I turned. From behind the pedestal of a carved group slunk Marakanoff. My premonition had been right. Some way he had escaped, slipped through to here. He held his hands high, came forward cautiously. "I am finished," he whispered. "Done. I don't know what they'll do to me." He nodded toward the handmaiden and Larry, now at the end of the bridge and passing on oblivious of all save each other. He drew closer. His eyes were sunken, burning, mad, his face etched with deep lines as though a graver's tool had cut down through it. I took a step backward. A grin like the grimace of a fiend blasted the Russian's visage. He threw himself upon me, his hands clenching at my throat. "Larry!" I yelled, and as I spun around under the shock of his onslaught, saw the two turn, stand paralyzed, and then race toward me. "But you'll carry nothing out of here!" shrieked Marakanoff. "No!" My foot, darting out behind me, touched vacancy. The roaring of the racing stream deafened me. I felt its mists about me, threw myself forward. I was falling, falling with the Russian's hands strangling me. I struck water, sank. The hands that gripped my throat relaxed for a moment their clutch. I strove to writhe loose, felt that I was being hurled with dreadful speed on. Full realization came, on the breast of that racing torrent dropping from some far ocean cleft and rushing. Where? A little time, a few breathless instants, I struggled with the devil who clutched me, inflexibly, indomitably. Then a shrieking as of all the pent winds of the universe in my ears. Blackness. Consciousness returned, slowly, agonizedly. A brilliant light was glowing through my closed lids. It hurt. I opened my eyes, closed them with swords and needles of dazzling pain shooting through them. Again I opened them cautiously. It was the sun. I staggered to my feet. Behind me was a shattered wall of basalt monoliths, hewn and squared. Before me was the Pacific, smooth and blue and smiling. And not far away, cast up on the strand even as I had been, was Marakanoff. He lay there, broken and dead indeed, yet all the waters through which we had passed, not even the waters of death themselves could wash from his face the grin of triumph. With the last of my strength I dragged the body from the strand and pushed it out onto the waves. A little billow ran up, coiled about it, and carried it away, ducking and bending. Another seized it, and another, playing with it. It floated from my sight. That which had been Marakanoff, with all his schemes to turn our fair world into an undreamed-of hell. My strength began to come back to me. I found a thicket, and slept. Slept it must have been for many hours, for when I again awakened, the dawn was rosing the east. I will not tell my sufferings. Suffice it to say that I found a spring and some fruit, and just before dusk had recovered enough to writhe up to the top of the wall and discover where I was. The place was one of the farther islets of the Nan Matal. To the north I caught the shadow of the ruins of Nan Tawak, where was the moon door, black against the sky. Where was the moon door, which someway, somehow, I must reach, and quickly? At dawn of the next day I got together driftwood, and bound it together in the shape of rough raft with fallen creepers. Then, with a makeshift paddle, I set forth for Nan Tawak. Slowly, painfully, I crept up to it. It was late afternoon before I grounded my shaky craft on the little beach between the ruined sea gates, and, creeping up to the giant steps, made my way to the inner enclosure. and at its opening I stopped, and the tears ran streaming down my cheeks while I wept aloud with sorrow and with disappointments and with weariness. For the great wall in which had been set the pale slab whose threshold we had crossed to the land of the Shining One lay shattered and broken. The monoliths were heaped about. The wall had fallen, and about them shone a film of water half covering them. There was no moon door. Dazed and weeping, I drew closer, climbed upon their outlying fragments. I had looked out only upon sea. There had been a great subsidence, an earth shock, perhaps, tilting downward all that side, the echo, little doubt, of that cataclysm which had blasted the dweller's lair. The little squared islet called Tau, in which were hidden the seven globes, had entirely disappeared. Upon the waters there was no trace of it. The moon door was gone. The passage to the moon pool was closed to me, its chamber covered by the sea. There was no road to Larry nor to Lachla. And there, for me, the world ended.
Citadel of Lost Ships, Part 4. Campbell stood still, not moving or speaking, his hard, dark face lined and dead, like old wood. From a great distance he heard Mara's smothered, furious curse, the quick catch of Stella's breath, the sudden breathing and stirring of the mob that was no longer sure what it wanted to do. But all he could see was the pale, kind face of an old man, smiling in the warm blue light, and the dirty, sordid stones of Lye. A voice spoke from beside the circle of armed men. Campbell heard it with some part of his brain. An old voice, dry and rustling, possessed of quiet dignity and great pain. "My children," it said, "have patience. Have faith that we, your leaders, have the good of Romani at heart." Campbell looked with dead, dark eyes at the speaker, standing beside Tredric, a small man in a robe of white fur, a Martian from one of the polar cities, frail, black-eyed, grave, and gently strong. "Remember the cold, the hunger, the uncertainty we have endured. We have a chance now for security and peace. Let there be no trouble, now or when the guard comes. Return to your quarters quietly."
"Trouble!"
Mara's voice roared out across the hot, still air. Every face down there below turned up toward the balcony. Campbell saw Tredric start and speak to one of the guards. The guard went out, not too fast. Campbell swore under his breath, and his heart began to tick over again, swift and hard. Mara thundered on, a bronze titan in the sultry glare. His gorget, his yellow eyes, the bosses on his kilt, held points of angry flame.
"You, Aaron Mac, a Martian, have you forgotten Kesh and Balakar and the wells of Tamboina? Can you crawl to the Coalition like a Sindar for the sake of the bones they throw you? You, Tredric, you've sold us out. Since when have Latniks been called to meddle in Romney's affairs?"
Tredric's voice was quite steady. "The Kralans are beyond reach, Mara. A revolt will get you nothing. Do you want blood on your hands?"
"My hand," said Mara softly.
His hook made a burning, vicious arc in the hot light. "If there's blood on this, the Coalition spilled it when their frontier marshal lopped my sword hand for raising it against him." The mob stirred and muttered, and Campbell said swiftly, "Tredric's right, but there's still a chance if you want to take it." Stella Moore put a hand on Mara's arm.
"How?"
Tredric was still pretending he hadn't seen Campbell, pretending there weren't men crawling through dark tunnels to trap him. "It'll mean trouble. It may mean death or imprisonment. It's a million-to-one shot. You'd better give me up and forget it." The point of Mara's hook pricked under his jaw.
"Speak quickly, little man."
"Okay, tell them to behave, then get me out of here fast." Tredric's men knew their way around. A lot of gypsies, moreover, who weren't with Tredric, joined the hunt for the Latnik. They didn't want trouble with the guard. Campbell stumbled through a maze of dark and stifling passages, holding still his hand and thinking of the guard ship sweeping closer. They were almost caught a dozen times, trying to get across Romani to his ship. The hunt seemed to be an outlet for the pent feelings of Romani. Campbell decided he would never go hunting again. And then, just above where his ship lay, they stepped into a trap. They were in the Saturnian quarter, in the hulk devoted to refugees from Titan. There were coolers working here. There was snow on the barren rocks, glimmering in weird light like a dark rainbow. "The caves," said Stella, "the Baraki." There was an echoing clamor of voices all around them, footsteps clattering over metal and icy rock. They ran, breathing hard. There were some low cliffs, and a ledge, and then caves with queer blue-violet fires burning in them. Creatures sat at the cave mouths. They were small, vaguely anthropoid, dead white, and unpleasantly rubbery. They were quite naked, and their single eyes were phosphorescent. Mara knelt. "Little fathers, we ask shelter, in the name of freedom." The shouts and the footsteps were closer. There was sweat on Campbell's forehead. One of the white things nodded slightly.
"No disturbance," it whispered. "We will have no disturbance of our thoughts. You may shelter to stop this ugly noise."
"Thank you, little father."
Mara plunged into the cave, with the others on his heels. Campbell snarled, "They'll come and take us!" Stella's sullen lips smiled wolfishly.
"No, watch."
The cave, the violet fire, was suddenly gone. There was a queer darkness, a small electric shiver across Campbell's skin. He started, and the girl whispered, "Telekinesis. They've built a wall of force around us. On the outside, it seems to be rock like the cave wall." Mara moved, the bosses on his kilt clinking slightly. "When the swine are gone, there's a trap in this hulk leading down to the pipe where your ship is. Now, tell us your plan." Campbell made a short, bitter laugh. "Plan, hell! It's a gamble on a fixed wheel, and you're fools if you play it."
"And if we don't?"
"I'm going anyway. The Kralans, well, I owe them something."
"Tell us the plan."
He did, in rapid, nervous sentences, crouched behind the shielding wall of thought from those alien brains. Mara laughed softly.
"By the gods, little man, you should have been a Keshi."
"I can think of a lot of things I should have been," said Campbell dourly. "Hey, there goes our wall." It hadn't been more than 4 minutes, long enough for them to look and go away again. There might still be time before the guard came. There was, just. The getaway couldn't have been more perfectly timed. Campbell grinned, feeding power into his jets with exquisite skill. He didn't have a Chinaman's chance. He thought probably the gypsies had less than that of coming through, but the Kralans weren't going to rot in the slave pens of Lia because of Roy Campbell, not while Roy Campbell was alive to think about it. And that, of course, might not be long. He sent the ship shooting toward the night side of Venus, in full view and still throttled down. The guard ships, 9 fast patrol boats, took out after him, giving Romany the go-by. No use stopping there, no mistaking that lean black ship, or whose hands were on the controls. Campbell stroked the firing keys, and the ship purred under him like a cat. Just for a second, he couldn't see clearly.
"I'm sorry, old girl," he said, "but that's how it has to be."
It was a beautiful chase. The card ships pulled every trick they knew, and they knew plenty. Campbell hunched over the keys, sweating, his dark face set in a grin that held no mirth. Only his hands moved with nervous, delicate speed. It was the ship that did it. They slapped tractors on her, and she broke them. They tried to encircle her, and she walked away from them. That slightage of power, that narrow margin of speed, pulled Roy Campbell away from what looked like instant, easy capture. He got into the shadow, and then the guard began to get scared as well as angry. They stopped trying to capture him. They unlimbered their blasters and went to work. Campbell was breathing hard now, through his teeth. His dark skin was oiled with sweat, pulled tight over the bones and the ridges of muscle and the knotted veins. Deliberately, he slowed a little. A bolt flamed past the starboard ports. He slowed still more and veered the slightest bit. The ship was alive under his hands. He didn't speak when the next bolt struck her, not even to curse. He didn't know he was crying until he tasted the salt on his lips. He got up out of the pilot's seat, and then he said one word.
"Judas!"
The follow-up of the first shot blasted the control panel. It knocked him back across the cockpit, seared and scorched from the fusing metal. He got up, somehow, and down the passage to the lock compartment. There was a lot of blood running from his cheek, but he didn't care. He could feel the ship dying under him. The timers were shot. She was running away in a crazy blind spiral, racking her plates apart. He climbed into his suit. It was a special one, black even to the helmet, with a special harness jet, illegally baffled. He hoped his hands weren't too badly burned. The ship checked brutally, flinging him hard into the bulkhead. Tractors! He clawed toward the lock, an animal whimper in his throat. He hoped he wasn't going to be sick inside the helmet. The panel opened. Air blasted him out into jet-black space. The tiny, spearing flame of the harness rocket flickered briefly and died, unnoticed among the trailing fires of the derelict. Campbell lay quite still in the blackened suit. The guard ships flared by, playing the derelict like a tarpon on the lines of their tractor beams. Campbell closed his eyes and cursed them, slowly and without expression, until the tightness in his throat choked him off. He let them get a long way off. Then he pressed the plunger of the rocket, heading down for the night-shrouded swamps of Tahara Province. He retained no very clear memory of the fall.
Once, when he was quite low, a spaceship blazed by over him, heading toward Lea. There were still about 8 hours' darkness over the swamps. He landed, eventually, in a clearing he was pretty sure only he knew about. He'd used it before, when he'd had stuff to fence in Lea, and wasn't sure who owned the town at the time. He'd learned to be careful about these things. There was a ship there now, a smallish trader of the interlunar type. He stared at it, not really believing it was there. Then, just in time, he got the helmet off. When the world stopped turning over, he was lying with his head in Stella's lap. She had changed her tunic for plain spaceman's black, and it made her face look whiter and lovelier in its frame of black hair. Her lips were still sullen, and still red. Campbell sat up and kissed them. He felt much better. Not good, but he thought he'd live. Stella laughed and said, "Well, you're recovering." He said, "Stella, you're good medicine for anything." A hand, which he recognized as Mara's, materialized out of the indigo gloom. It had a flask in it. Campbell accepted it gladly. Presently, the icy deadness around his stomach thawed out, and he could see things better. He got up, rather unsteadily, and fumbled for a cigarette. His shirt had been mostly blown and charred off him, and his hands hurt like hell. Stella gave him a smoke and a light. He sucked it in gratefully and said, "Okay, kids, are we all ready?" They were. Campbell led off. He drained the flask, and was pleased to find himself firing on all jets again. He felt empty and relaxed and ready for anything. He hoped the liquor wouldn't wear off too soon. There was a path threaded through the hummocks, the bogs and potholes and reeds and liha trees. Only Campbell, who had made it, could have followed it. Remembering his blind stumbling in the mazes of Romany, he felt pleased about that. He said, rather smugly, "Be careful not to slip. How do you fix the getaway?" Mara made a grim little laugh. "Romany was a madhouse hunting for you. Some of the hot-headed boys started minor wars over policy on top of that. Tredric had to use most of his men to keep order. Besides, of course, he thought we were beaten on the Kraylin question." "There were only 4 men guarding the locks," said Stella. "Mara and a couple of the panicky boys took care of them." Campbell remembered the spaceship flashing toward Lea. He told them about it. Could be Tredric coming to supervise our defeat in person. Defeat! It was because he was a little tight, of course, but he didn't think anyone could defeat him this night. He laughed. Something rippled out of the indigo night to answer his laughter, something so infinitely sweet and soft that it made him want to cry, and then shocked him with the deep and iron power in it. Campbell looked back over his shoulder. He thought, "Me hell, these are the guys who'll do it if it's done." Stella was behind him. Behind her was a thin, small man with 4 arms. He wore no clothing, but his own white fur, and his head was covered with feathery antennae. Even in the blue night, the antennae and the man's eyes burned living scarlet. He came from Callisto, and he carried in his 4 hands a thing vaguely like a harp, only the strings were double-banked. It was the harp that had spoken. Campbell hoped it would never speak against him. Mara brought up the rear, swinging along with no regard for the burden he bore. Over his naked shoulder, Campbell could see the still, white face of the Baraki from Titan, the little father who had saved them from the hunters. There were tentacles around Mara's big body like white ropes. 4 gypsies and a public enemy. 5 little people against the Terran Venusian coalition. It didn't make sense. A hot, slow wind stirred the liha trees. Campbell breathed it in and grinned. What goes, he wondered, and stopped to part a tangle of branches. There was a stone-lined tunnel beyond. Here we go, children. Join hands and make like little mousies. He took Stella's hand in his left. Because it was Stella's, he didn't mind the way it hurt. In his right, he held his gun. Part 5. He led them, quickly and quietly, along the disused branch of an old drainage system that he had used so often as a private entrance. Presently, they dropped to a lower level and the conduit system proper. When the rains were on, the drains would be running full. Now they were only pumping seepage. They waited in pitch darkness, bypassed a pumping station through a side tunnel once used for cold storage by one of Lia's cautious businessmen, and then found steep, slippery steps going up. "Careful," whispered Campbell. He stopped them on a narrow ledge and stood listening. The Callistan murmured, with faint amusement, "There is no one beyond." Antennae over ears. Campbell grinned and found a hidden spring. "Lea is full of these things," he said. "The boys used to keep their little wars going just for fun, and every smart guy had several bolt holes. Maps used to sell high."
They emerged in a very deep, very dark cellar. It was utterly still. Campbell felt a little sad. He could remember when Martian Max was the busiest thieves' market in Ye, and a man could hear the fighting even here. He smiled bitterly and led the way upstairs. Presently they looked down on the main gate, the main square, and the slave pens of Ye. The surrounding streets were empty, the buildings mostly dark. The Coalition had certainly cleaned up when it took over the town. It was horribly depressing. Campbell pointed. Reception committee. Tridrick radioed anyway. One'll get you 20, he followed it up in person. The gate was floodlighted over a wide area, and there were a lot of tough-looking men with heavy-duty needle guns. In this day of anesthetic charges, you could do a lot of effective shooting without doing permanent damage. There were more lights, and more men by the slave pens. Campbell couldn't see much over the high stone walls of the pens. Vague movement, the occasional flash of a brilliant crest. He had known the Kralans would be there. It was the only place in Ye where you could imprison a lot of people and be sure of keeping them. Campbell's dark face was cruel. "Okay," he said. "Let's go." Down the stone steps to the entrance. Stella's quick breathing in the hot darkness. The rhythmic clink of the bosses on Mara's kilt. Campbell saw the eyes of the Callistan Harper, glowing red and angry. He realized he was sweating. He had forgotten his burns. Stella opened the heavy steel-sheathed door, quietly, slowly. The Baraki whispered, "Put me down." Mara set him gently on the stone floor. He folded in upon himself, tentacles around white, rubbery flesh. His single eye burned with a cold phosphorescence. He whispered, "No." The Callistan Harper went to the door. Reflected light painted him briefly, white fur and scarlet crest and outlandish harp, and the glowing, angry eyes. He vanished. Out of nowhere, the harp began to sing. Through the partly open door, Campbell had a clear view of the square and the gate. In all that glare of light on empty stone, nothing moved, and yet the music rippled out. The guards, Campbell could see the startled glitter of their eyeballs in the light. There was nothing to shoot at. The harping was part of the night, as all-enveloping and intangible. Campbell shivered. A pulse beat like a trip hammer under his jaw. Stella's voice came to him, a faint breath out of the darkness. "The Baraki is shielding him with thought, a wall of force that turns the light." The edge of the faint light touched her cheek, the blackness of her hair. Mara crouched beyond her, motionless. His hook glinted dully, curved and cruel. They were getting only the feeble backwash of the harping. The Callistan was aiming his music outward. Campbell felt it sweep and tremble, blend with the hot, slow wind and the indigo sky. It was some trick of vibration, some diabolical thrusting of notes against the brain, like fingers to press and control. Something about the double-banked strings thrumming against each other under the cunning of four skilled hands, but it was like witchcraft. "The harp of Dagda," whispered Stella, and the Irish music in her voice was older than time. The Scot in Campbell answered it. Somewhere outside a man cursed, thickly, like one drugged with sleep and afraid of it. A gun went off with a sharp slapping sound. Some of the guards had fallen down. The harp sang louder, throbbing along the gray stones. It was the slow wind, the heat, the deep blue night. It was sleep. The floodlights blazed on empty stones, and the guards slept. The Baraki sighed and shivered and closed his eye. Campbell saw the Callistan Harper standing in the middle of the square, his scarlet crest erect, striking the last thrumming note. Campbell straightened, catching his breath in a ragged sob. Mara picked up the Baraki. He was limp like a tired child. Stella's eyes were glistening and strange. Campbell went out ahead of them. It was a long way across the square, in the silence and the glaring lights. Campbell thought the harp was a nice weapon. It didn't attract attention, because everyone who heard it slept. He flung back the three heavy bars of the slave gate. The pain of his burned hands jarred him out of the queer mood the harping and his Celtic blood had put on him. He began to think again. "Hurry!" he snarled at the Kralans. "Hurry up!" They came pouring out of the gate, men, women with babies, little children. Their crests burned in the sullen glare. Campbell pointed to Mara. "Follow him." They recognized him, tried to speak, but he cursed them on, and then an old man said, "My son." Campbell looked at him, and then down at the stones. "For God's sake, father, hurry." A hand touched his shoulder gently. He looked up again and grinned. He couldn't see anything. "Get the hell on, will you?" Somebody found the switch, and the nearer lights went out. The hand pressed his shoulder and was gone. He shook his head savagely. The Kralans were running now, toward the house. And then, suddenly, Mara yelled. Men were running into the square, 8 or 10 of them, probably the bodyguard of the burly gray-haired man who led them. Beside the gray-haired man was Tridrick, overchief of the Terran Quarter of Romani. They were startled. They hadn't been expecting this. Campbell's battle-trained eye saw that. Probably they had been making a routine tour of inspection and just stumbled into the crash-out. Campbell fired from the hip. Anesthetic needles sprayed into the close-packed group. Two of them went down, the rest scattered, dropping flat. Campbell wished there had been more time to kill the gate lights. At least the shadows made shooting tricky. He bent over and began to run, guarding the rear of the Kralin's line. Stella, in the cover of the doorway, was laying down a methodical wall of needles. Campbell grinned. Some of the Kralins caught it, and had to be carried. That slowed things down. Campbell's gun clicked empty. He shoved in another clip, cursing his burned fingers. A charge sang by him, close enough to stir his hair. He fired again, blanketing the whole sector where the men lay. He wished he could blow Tredrick's head off. The Kralins were vanishing into the house. Mara and the Kalistan had gone ahead, leading them. Campbell groaned. Speed was what they needed. Speed! A child, separated from his mother in the rush, knelt on the stones and shrieked. Campbell picked him up and ran on. Enemy fire was slackening. Stella was doing all right. The last of the Kralins shoved through the door. Campbell bounded up the steps. Stella got up off her belly and smiled at him. Her eyes shone. They were halfway through the door when the cold voice behind them said, "There are lethal needles in my gun. You had better stop." Campbell turned slowly. His face was wooden. Tredrick stood at the bottom of the steps. He must have crawled around the edge of the square, where the shadows were thick under the walls. "Drop your gun, Campbell, and you, Stella Moore." Campbell dropped it. Tredrick might be bluffing about those needles, but a Mickey at this stage of the game would be just as fatal. Stella's gun clattered beside him. She didn't say anything, but her face was coldly murderous. Tredrick said evenly, "You might as well call them back, Campbell. You led them in, but you're not going to lead them out." It was funny, Campbell thought, how a man's voice could be so cold when his eyes had fire in them. He said sullenly, "Okay, Tredrick, you win. But what's the purpose behind this?" Tredrick's face might have been cut from granite, except for the feral eyes. "I was born on Romani. I froze and starved in those rotten hulks. I hated it. I hated the darkness, the loneliness, the uncertainty. But when I said I hated it, I got a beating. Everybody else thought it was worth it. I didn't. They talked about freedom, but Romani was a prison to me. I wanted to grow, and I was stifled inside it. Then I got an idea. If I could rule Romani and make a treaty with the Coalition, I'd have money and power, and I could fix it so no more kids would be brought up that way, cold and hungry and scared. Mara opposed me, and then the Kralins became an issue." Tredrick smiled, but there was no mirth or softness in it. "It's a good thing. The Coalition can take care of Mara and you others who were mixed up in this. My way is clear." Stella said softly between her teeth, "They'll never forgive you for turning Romani people over to the Latniks. There'll be war." Tredrick nodded soberly. "No great change is made without bloodshed. I'm sorry for that, but Romani will be happier." "We don't ask to be happy. We only ask to be free." Campbell said wearily, "Stella, take the kid, will you?" He held out the little Kralin, droopy and quiet now. She looked at him in quick alarm. His feet were spread but not steady. His head sunk forward. She took the child. Campbell's knees sagged. One seared arm in a tattered green sleeve came up to cover his face. The other groped blindly along the wall. He dropped rather slowly to his knees. The groping hand fell across the gun by Stella's foot. In one quick sweep of motion, Campbell got it, threw it, and followed it with his own body. The gun missed, but it came close enough to Tredrick's face to make him move his hand. The involuntary muscular contraction of his whole body spoiled his aim. The charge went past Campbell into the wall. They crashed down together on the stones. Campbell gripped Tredrick's wrist, knew he couldn't hold it, let it go with one hand and slashed backwards with his elbow at Tredrick's face. The gun let off again, harmlessly. Tredrick groaned. His arm was weaker. Campbell thrashed over and got his knee on it. Tredrick's other fist was savaging his already tortured body. Campbell brought his fist down into Tredrick's face. He did it twice, and wept and cursed because he was suddenly too weak to lift his arm again. Tredrick was bleeding, but far from out. His gun was coming up again. He didn't have much play, but enough. Campbell set his teeth. He couldn't even see Tredrick, but he swung again. He never knew whether he connected or not. Something thrummed past his head. He couldn't say he heard it. It was more like feeling. But it was something deadly and strange. Tredrick didn't make a sound. Campbell knew suddenly that he was dead. He got up, very slow, shaking and cold. The Kalistan Harper stood in the doorway. He was lowering his hands, and his eyes were living coals. He didn't say anything. Neither did Stella. But she laughed, and the child stirred and whimpered in her arms. Campbell went to her. She looked at him with a queer eyes and whispered, "I called him with my mind. I knew he'd kill." He took her face in his own two hands. "Listen, Stella, you've got to lead them back. You've got to touch my mind with yours and let me guide you that way, back to the ship." Her eyes widened sharply. "But you can come. He's dead. You're free now." "No." He could feel her throat quiver under his hands. Her blood was beating, so was his. He said harshly, "You fool, do you think they'll let you get away with this? You're tackling the Coalition. They can't afford to look silly. They've got to have a scapegoat. Something to save face. Romany, so far, is beyond planetary control. Slap your tractors on her, tow her out. Clear out to Saturn if you have to. Nobody saw the Calliston. Nobody saw anybody but me and the Kralins and an unidentifiable somebody up here on the porch. Nobody, that is, but Tredric. And he won't talk. Do you understand?" She did, but she was still rebellious. Her sullen lips were angry, her eyes bright with tears and challenging. "But you, Roy!" He took his hands away. "Damn you, woman! If I hide out on Romany, I bring you into guard jurisdiction. I'll be trapped, and Romany's last chance to stay free will be gone." She said stubbornly, "But you can get away. There are ships." "Oh, sure, but the Kralins are there. You can't hide them. The Coalition will search Romany. They'll ask questions. I tell you, they've got to have a goat." He was really weak now. He hoped he could hold out. He hoped he wouldn't do anything disgraceful. He turned away from her, looking out at the square. Some of the guards were beginning to stir. "Will you go?" he said. "Will you get to hell out?" She put her hand on him. "Roy." He jerked away. His dark face was set and cruel. "Do you have to make it harder? Do you think I want to rot on Phobos and their stinking mines, with shackles on my feet?" He swung around, challenging her with savage eyes. "How else do you think Romany is going to stay free? You can't go playing cat and mouse with the big shots this way. They're getting sick of it. They'll pass laws and tie you down. Somebody's got to spread Romany all over the solar system. Somebody's got to pull a publicity campaign that'll make the great dumb public sit up and think. If public opinion's with you, you're safe." He smiled. "I'm big news, Stella. I'm Roy Campbell. I can splash your lousy little mess of tin cans all over with glamour, so the great dumb public won't let a hair of your little head be hurt. If you want to, you can raise a statue to me in the council hall. And now will you for God's sake let go?" She wasn't crying. Her gray eyes had lights in them. He was ashamed, then. "In my racket, you don't expect to get away with it forever. Besides, I'm an old dog. I know my way around. I have a little money saved up. I won't be in for long." "I hope not," she said. "Oh, Roy, it's so stupid. Why do Earthmen have to change everything they lay their hands on?" He looked at Tredric, lying on the stones. His voice came slow and somber. "They're building, Stella. When they're finished, they'll have a big, strong, prosperous empire extending all across the system, and the people who belong to that empire will be happy. But before you can build, you have to grade and level, destroy the things that get in your way. We're the things, the tree stumps and the rocks that grew in the way and can't be changed. They're building, they're growing, you can't stop that. In the end, it'll be a good thing, I suppose, but right now, for us..." He broke off. He thrust her roughly inside and locked the steel-sheathed door. "You've got to go now." It was dark and hot. The Kralin child whimpered. He could feel Stella close to him. He found her lips and kissed them. He said, "So long. And about that statue, you'd better wait until I come back to pose for it." His voice became a longing whisper. "I will be back," he promised.
Arborus Precatorius. Acacia arabica. Acacia catechu. Acacia senegal. Acer rubrum. Achillea millefolium. Achillea tarmica. Aconitum napellus. Acorus calamus. Actaea spicata. Adiantum capulus veneris. Adonis vernalis. Aigle marmulus. Aigopodium podagraria. Aesculus hippocastarum. Aethusa cinapium. Afromomum melegueta. Agrimonia eupatoria. Aelanthus altissima. Ayuga hymepitis. Ayuga reptiles. Alcaea rosea. Alcanilla vulgaris. Aletris faronosa. Alisma plantago aquatica. Alcana tinctoria. Allium keppa. Allium sativum. Allium squenoprasum. Allium ursinum. Alnus glutinosa. Aloe barbadensis. Aloysia trifilla. Alpinia officinarum.
Alstonia constricta, Althaia officinalis, Amantina muscaria, Amaranthus hypochondriacus, Ami visnaga.